You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
This week's Major Spoilers podcast goes out to Nathan Olson, who I'm pretty sure ran the Walnut Grove Boutique and sold everybody all their clothes and food and pretty much everything, because yeah, it's a general store. In any case, we appreciate all of our spoilerites, but this one goes out to you.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, we dodge a bullet and remain a triad, past pluperfect, present tense, and future people. There's an ominous shadow in the streets of New Tokyo tonight. Tetsuo! DC shows us Selina's afterglow, and after seeing their giant-sized man-thing, Marvel wants to double on the point one. I am the boiling man come to break the bones of your sins. I am morphine in a wooden leg. I am vengeance among the shattered remnants of lives long dead. I am the fairy pixie. Hark and listen to my tale. The Major Spoilers podcast is in the wind and the rain and the darkness of night and on the air.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Major Spoilers podcast. So glad you could join us this week. Lots of good stuff coming up, including a discussion of The Crow. No, not the movie, but the original James O'Barr book that came out in the 1980s, late 80s, and then again in the 90s, because it got canceled for about 3 years.
It didn't get canceled. He just stopped. Canceled would imply that it
that someone
told,
else.
No, don't make anymore. With it.
Yeah, Caliber Press. The sales fell short of the company's expectations, and they canceled the title. Tundra eventually picked it up 3 years later and finished out the volumes. Later still, the rights would go to the now-defunct Kitchen Sink Press. So there you go.
That's what they used to call me in college.
Kitchen Sink Press, or defunct?
Now defunct.
We'll be talking more about The Crow later in the show, but for now, let's get to some news. No, there's already a third Sherlock Holmes movie in the works, with the second one hasn't even been released yet.
I haven't seen any of those.
Mattel buys Hit Entertainment. Hit Entertainment, of course, being the Thomas the Tank Engine series and some of the other ones. Thank God it doesn't include Naughty. Mm-hmm. Live action Akira is back in production. The Punisher headed to the small screen. And Marvel pumps Point One orders. Let's roll that Wheel of Destiny and see where it lands. Round and round it goes. Landing on number 3, Akira. It's a story we haven't heard in about 2 years. Leonardo DiCaprio, that was when the big news broke, was that he was going to produce a live-action version of the famous Japanese anime. It's going to be set in Neo New York.
Neo New York.
Which got everybody all upset. Quit whitewashing Akira. Quit putting white actors in Akira. And at that time, they were talking Keanu Reeves to play Canada.
Canada.
Then that got shipped and shelved, and people were just like, this is too hot to touch. Until this week, when Akira is finally getting the green light from Warner Brothers Productions, telling DiCaprio, go ahead and produce this mother. And let's get going.
There you go.
And of course, the whitewashing of the actors continues. Two big names.
What does that even mean?
Putting white actors in the place of the Asian actors or the Asian roles. Two of the big names that are already being floated around for minor parts in the movie. Well, I guess it depends on how minor and how many changes are going on. The Colonel. Remember the Colonel? He's the one that fires the big space platform weapon. Rumored to be offered to Gary Oldman. And then Lady he's Miyako. Dracula. I think she's the seer that they come carrying around, and she's always yelling and screaming and trying to get the crowds riled up. Helena Bonham Carter.
Makes sense.
Okay. Those are the two people. And then, of course, there might be Garrett Hedlund, might be playing Canada in that movie. But that's all rumor and speculation right now, although I do understand that they are in talks for that. Matthew, what do you think of this?
I think that people are making a lot about... I think they're putting a little too much emphasis on the fact that the American cinema remakes movies all the time from all different places and all different countries and all different worlds.
Yeah, we just
the American
about
cinema
Old Boy a few
steals
weeks ago.
Everything from everyone.
So does American
and,
television.
You know, it's the equivalent of being angry that, you know, Fred Sanford was played by Red Fox when in the original English thing he was someone different. I can see the point. And, you know, I can definitely see as where you could make a point that it's racism. And certainly people have the right to make that point. I don't think that's the point of what's going on here. I think it's another question of, you know, what would make an interesting movie? This property. Let's make a movie of the Addams Family. Let's make a movie of Frankenberry. Let's make a movie of the Rubik's Cube. Akira is a recognizable name. They're going to try and make a movie of it. If it sucks, you still have the original book. You still have the movie from 1980, Bloody Blue. You still have the remake where Canada was voiced by a Power Ranger. All of that still exists. You know, I feel like people are going way overboard yet again with something that we haven't even really heard anything but vague production notes about.
One of the things that is interesting about this is that when you look at the last time that Akira was released in the United States, well, this is going all the way back to 1989. The movie has been released in the United States twice. Once in the original, well, when it was moved over from Japan. And then again for the 20th anniversary, I think it got a limited run. You know how much money it's been brought in the United States?
$6.
$550,000 in the last... you know, 20 plus years, 30 years.
Does that include like video sales?
That doesn't include video. We're just talking about box office. So, you know, the number of people who have watched the movie are probably fairly slim.
Yes.
Outside of the pop culture circle.
Right, certainly.
And even then, I'm going to bet that
if you look at the broad movie watching or movie going audience, yes.
Yeah,
the number of people who have seen Akira are going to be minority, certainly.
I'm going to be guessing about 1% or less of the people have seen Akira, of the movie going public. So nobody knows anything about Akira. And so they're going to hear this and they're going to see Gary Oldman and they're going to see Bonham Carter attached to this, and they're going to see whoever else is attached to this, and they're going to go, ooh, name power, star power, because that's what draws audiences in.
Produced by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Produced by Leonardo DiCaprio, and then people are going to go to the theater to see that. They might have a little bit of a disconnect when they see Akira, white people, New York, etc. That might be
Why
a little bit of a...
Why would people who haven't seen it have a disconnect?
Well, when you say Akira, Rodrigo, do you think... Do you think Irish immigrants?
I'm not an accurate test subject. honestly, most people aren't gonna. Again, then you're supposing a certain amount of knowledge of Japanese names.
True.
Even at that point, I mean, really, if you ambush somebody on the street and say, "What do you think of when I say Akira?" They're like, "Pirates of the Caribbean."
They could. Yeah, I think for the most part, though, that 99%, they're not going to have seen of Akira because they're too busy occupying Wall Street, obviously.
So you can show them whatever you want and call it Akira, and they're not going to know
it
that it's
Bob.
Different. Bob.
They should call the movie Bob.
Well, the good thing about Akira is that there are two central characters, possibly three. You can say there are three main characters, and none of them are Akira.
No, they're not.
Which is kind of what I've always liked about it.
Right.
Because it's still a name so it doesn't quite put you in that run die hard situation. But it's still none of the characters that you see in the movie are actually Akira.
You know, of the people that have seen the movie, I'm going to bet even fewer have read the 25 odd volumes.
I certainly haven't.
I think I've read up to about volume 12 or 15, something like that. And then I moved and somebody tossed them in the trash.
No.
That's why she's not married to her anymore.
Ex-wife!
I thought it was your mom. That was like
no, quintessential
mom throughway the comics.
No.
I think that it's important to note, though, when you say they're whitewashing, the characters that they've talked about, the ones that we know that they're interested in talking to an actor about possibly taking a role in a movie that may not yet happen.
Oh, no, it's been given the green light, so it's happening.
Characters.
Well, no. Even after movies
green
are green
light doesn't mean a movie's going to happen.
They sometimes get shelved. Yeah, I mean, movies have been fully produced.
Oh, yeah, I realize
and then
that.
Shelved.
Yeah. This one, though,
but
I
I'm
bet they're going to get this one in the theaters.
Oh, sure. At this point, they are in. They're talking about who they would like to see, who they would offer a part two, and neither of these roles are the major roles.
No,
none
not.
Of these.
The
are,
only one is
the
Garrett Hedlund, who might be in talks to play Canada.
The whole country?
No,
America's hat.
Well, all they have to do is separate like the upper part of his head from his jaw and just have it flop around.
Hey, buddy.
I'm not yet.
What's going on over here? Fart.
Yeah, where's all the spooky music going to come from? And the disjointed flashbacks to little old children holding up their hands with the number 13 on it.
There is a lot going on in Akira. Like, a lot of stuff going on in Akira.
And that's why...
And just in the movie. And the movie's what, like two and a half hours long?
Almost 2 hours, yeah.
You know, not even concern, but my biggest curiosity about this is what's going to stay and what's going to go. And my fear is that most of it is going to go. That it's going to turn into, yes, a movie about a guy gaining psychic powers and fighting around and being a bad person, but that it's also going to not include a lot of the really creepy imagery, a lot of the conspiracy theory stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very moody piece of work. It's a very specific, it has a very specific aesthetic.
Yeah.
And that is what I'm most afraid will be lost. Now, if, of course, you can have issues when somebody tries to do such a faithful translation that, you know, into another style, like a live action style, and then it mm-hmm. might fall flat. Mm-hmm. Some might say that was part of the problem with Watchmen, was that really strong necessity to get everything as close to the book as possible.
Well, that's going to be impossible, because like I said, if you've read it and the books,
you know, people have normal sized eyes, it's going to be very difficult.
Well, in the way it was released in Japan, there's 6 volumes, right? Mm-hmm. In the United States, depending on who was publishing it, at first they started out with like slices of the volume, so mm-hmm. it was like 4 issues per volume or something like that, to where you get up to 15 plus, and then they started doing them as larger collected editions. There is a heck of a lot more, especially when you look at the colonel and what's going on in the military side, mm-hmm. and especially what happens after they shoot the space weapon from the platform down into to the Tokyo Stadium. There is so much, especially with the religious aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even the movie barely touches on what's really going on.
Right.
And so a live action movie, there's no way that they're going to be able to incorporate that into it. So you're going to get focused on somebody has powers, somebody's trying to stop the powers. There is the craziness that happens with the body going all explodey and morphy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fire a space weapon at it in the end. And then somebody stands up at the end and is walking away as the waves lap at the remains of New York City.
And the prom is tomorrow!
While Journey music fires up in the background.
Dude, Journey doesn't do music anymore.
Oh no, this is going
to
be a period.
They don't need to. They play the same song every time.
So it's interesting. I for one, want to see what happens with it.
I'm very interested in the process.
Yeah. There was even, I was trying to find it really quickly, but George Takei actually made a comment about Akira on this petition a while ago. This was back in April. But I can't find his exact quote. He did sign a petition and he made a quote about it. So people can go and look that up
to get it done or to.
Well, at one point in the casting, they were looking at Justin Timberlake to also be in the movie. Hmm. And again, that hasn't been ruled out.
Right.
But who knows? So Justin Timberlake, he's actually a pretty good actor.
Yeah. And he's got an action movie coming out here.
Oh, does he?
Soon.
Oh yeah. That Time, whatever it is.
Yeah. Time to die,
Justin Timberlake.
Die, Timberlake, die.
You know, there's another Die Hard movie coming out on Valentine's Day. All right, everybody. You can head over to MajorSpoilers.com. You can read about this Akira movie. Plus, you can read all about Marvel pumping up the orders for their Point One launch, essentially doubling all of the issues being sent to retailers. If you ordered 20, they send you 40.
Wow.
If you ordered 80, they send you 160.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many if they order you 77?
They will send you 152.
154.
Ah! No, they're going to send you 152 because that's the way Marvel works.
Math is fun. Let's go shopping.
All right, everybody. Also, people have been asking about this and waiting for this. Over in the Major Spoilers store, over at majorspoilers.com/store, you can buy the official Critical Hit t-shirt.
Whoa.
It is pure awesome. Rodrigo was just looking at it a moment ago and going, wow, the pictures just do not do this thing justice.
Yes.
It is awesome upon awesome.
It really is.
And it's only $19.95.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What if I am really gigundous?
Like how gigundous?
Like gigundous enough that I can still wear shirts.
Then you're not gigundous enough. All
right.
But let's just say you are all the way up to 4X gigundous.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a shirt and we're not charging you extra.
That
if you
is,
look at it,
that is
crazy. A large has a certain amount of fabric in it.
Uh-huh.
A quad extra large has four times the fabric in it.
Yes, I'm sure it's a direct. Every X is actually a multiplier.
And thus, we're still charging you the same amount for four times the fabric.
Wow.
Four times the dead worms that wove the silken threads.
The dead nylon worms.
The nylon worms. You can find out more about the Critical Hit t-shirt. If you're going to order it, I would order it now. This is a product that's not going out of the store,
mm-hmm.
but the first order will ship on November 10th. So
right.
If you want to get it, you better order it now, because who knows how many are going to be in the store before we have to order some more.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Meaning we ordered a bunch of them. Those will come in. We'll ship those out.
If you order after November something.
Yes.
You
may
have
to wait until we build
it,
until we buy yep. a new batch. So, and you've heard my complaints against our t-shirt person. Mm. Seems though when you're saying I'd like to order 250 shirts, we'll have that ready for you next week. Sir.
Oh,
it's my good sir.
Right away.
Oh,
can I interest you in some caviar while you wait?
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will get to some reviews.
How to get a Major Spoilers shout-out. If you want to get a personalized shout-out at the top of the show, all you have to do is the following steps. Number 1. Visit MajorSpoilers.com. 2. Click on the Make a Donation button. 3. Donate $10 or more to the cause. 4. Sit back and relax and hear Matthew butcher your name and say something cute about you. Major Spoilers, bringing the good stuff since 2006.
And once again, thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the Major Spoilers website, to the Major Spoilers cause, to the Major Spoilers experience.
Mm-hmm.
The experience includes what, Rodrigo?
It includes the Major Spoilers website.
Right, and all the fantastic content that's there.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Up to 3 podcasts.
three different. I thought you meant 3 podcasts, like this episode and 2 others.
Yeah.
Major Spoilers podcast,
uh-huh.
Critical Hit podcast, and our brand new Top 5 podcast.
Top 5!
Woohoo! And what else?
You can follow Major Spoilers on Twitter.
Yes.
You can also follow probably 3 other guys on Twitter.
Yes.
You can go to the Major Spoilers forums.
Yes.
and get a username and talk to people about stuff there.
Yes! Wow, all of that, Rodrigo,
for free. We're also kind of on Facebook.
Yeah, kind of, maybe.
And we have
until the end of the month, whenever they shut our Facebook page down.
We have a mild Google Plus presence.
Oh, yeah, mild. We did a little live chat a few weeks ago with somebody.
Yeah, we did a hangout, yeah.
Yeah, so be on the lookout for that. And if you think that that entire package, the website, the podcast, the forums, the chats, the thingings, and the thungers, and the framostats, as Matthew is so fond of saying again and again, if that's worth something to you, you can do a one-time donation, or you can do $5, $10, or $10 a month. $10 a month will get you a show dedicated just to you, just like Matthew did at the top of the show to our dear, 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 dear friend, Merlin Olsen.
Mary Kate Olsen.
Yes.
Merlin Jones.
Yes. The great NATO. Let's talk about some reviews.
Reviews.
Wait, before we talk about reviews, I have a correction to make.
Uh-oh, a correction.
Yeah, I got an email from my mom, and she was like,
You know I listen to your show, Rodrigo, and you are burning in hell this weekend.
Yes. She's like, do not expect to be fed when you come back home.
Why would your mom send you an email?
Well, first off, I think my mom takes, you know, doesn't necessarily roll with a whole me kind of maybe making fun of my parents a little bit, which I only do it because I like them. Really, I only make fun of people I like. And
wait a minute, you've never made fun of me.
Yeah, well, anyway, but she also sent me an email with a correction because I believe I said that menudo was soup.
Yes.
But it's technically not. It's a stew. And it wasn't so much me not knowing what it was so much as I just think as anything that has, you know, up to 40% broth to be a soup.
Oh, yeah,
it's just like, this soup has some meat in it.
I guess it depends on the company that you're dealing with. Because, you know, if it's like Campbell's and you're getting chicken noodle soup, it's like 99% broth and 1% noodles and chicken. But if you go like with Hormel, you know, it's like 10% broth and
but it's still
99% byproducts.
So I mean, it is a.
I can see that. I can see that as a mistake.
And she actually told me, and I don't know what these are called in English, but there are four parts to the beef's to a cow's stomach.
Okay,
and you can actually make a specific type of menudo out of each of them, or mix them all.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
So variations on a theme.
Yes.
You can have one stomach or all four.
Yes. But just so you know, they are in fact the stomach of a cow. So if you're, you know, squeamish about viscera, then...
Yeah, but you know, you cook that stuff up, it tastes just like octopus.
Yeah, pretty much. And it kind of has that consistency, a lot of it. It you know, it has that squishiness, but it also holds that... that flavor really well because that's kind of what a stomach does.
Yes, exactly. Holds the flavor in.
It's just a, you know, porous stomach lining. Doesn't that sound delicious?
Matthew,
I think it does.
Matthew, speaking of things that are delicious, how about that Fear Itself, the home front from Marvel Comics?
I am literally speechless. Literally speechless. And not about Fear Itself, the home front, colon. Although that as well.
Is this a seventh issue?
Yes.
Is this yes, a scene from the perspective of What's-Her-Face, the reporter?
God, no. I hate her.
Okay.
Sally Floyd? Sally Floyd can blow me. No, this is... Fear Itself, the home front, is basically a continuation of Marvel's tendency to have, quote-unquote, the home front. It doesn't really have a whole lot of ties to the previous home fronts from Civil War, Secret Invasion, and I believe something about the War of 1812. This book is split between Speedball, The Chosen, and then little one-page bits and pieces here and there. Each issue has had different individual bits, but...
So is it an anthology? Or is it a mishmash of just stuff?
Isn't an anthology a mishmash of stuff?
Well, but you're saying there's like a one page and a tidbit.
Basically, I think what it is it's an anthology, all of which takes place during whatever event it's covering.
Okay.
So this, in this case, Fear Itself.
Okay.
So, yes, it's an anthology and a mishmash. A mythology, if you will. Honestly, the weakest part of the story for me is the story. Because the speedball portion has art by Mike Mayhew. And Mike Mayhew is kind of like Greg Horn combined with Greg Land. In that he has kind of an almost photorealistic style in terms of faces and his imagery. But the whole point of this is that several years ago, during or at the outlook of what became the Superhuman Civil War, the New Warriors were in Stamford, Connecticut, and blew up the whole town. Mm-hmm. Now, they really didn't. Nitro went nuts. But this seven-issue part of it has been Speedball trying to come to terms with Miriam, I believe her name is, the woman who has started an entire coalition against young superheroes and against what the New Warriors did. Now, of course, this being fear itself, everybody's been afraid for seven issues. She and Speedball fight off supervillains together because that's what soccer moms do. And then they come to terms and she says, I don't have to like you, but if you want to come to Stanford again, you don't have to hide. Now, previous issues of Fear Itself have given Speedball basically this weird kind of flash mob thing where he's been running around with his iPhone taking pictures to try and make everybody less scared.
Mm-hmm.
And it apparently worked. So that happened. The second part of the story is basically forgettable. X-23, Power Man, Spider-Girl, Amadeus Cho, and the new Thunderstrike have all been gathered together as sort of a new super team. And the solicitation for this issue says, will they become a team? I hate solicitations like that because there's two answers. There's yes, they will, or no, they won't. And either way, I'm irritated. Because we get to the end of this story, and it turns out, no, they won't, and X-23 actually kicks Amadeus Cho in the nards. I'm not sure why, however. There's a one-page bit by Howard Chaykin. There's a bit of backstory with Phil, the bald guy from Oklahoma, who gave Captain America a gun in issue 6 of Fear Itself. It's very uneven. The whole issue is very uneven. And the parts of it that really work for me, the parts of it that I'm thinking, yes, this is great. This is really awesome and super cool. I'm kind of confused by, because at the end of Fear Itself, it seemed like Captain America was making a stand in New York, but here it seems he's making a stand in Broxton, Oklahoma. And they just kind of lost me. And the issue starts with this very important thing that says, please read Fear Itself number 7 before you read this issue. Matthew's assessment is that won't help you. This is a lot of ancillary material. This is basically the director's cut without the movie. This is the CD extras. The best parts of it are inconsistent. 1.5 slices of meatloaf. Fear Itself, the home front. If you read all 7 issues, I'm sure we'll make a lovely trade paperback. But these particular stories don't really mesh. They don't really do anything other than say, boy, that crossover sure is over. And, you know, given how the crossover ended, I was a little frustrated anyway. So not the best thing that I've read from Marvel this week.
Oh, that is a shame. What was the best thing you read from Marvel this week?
Best thing I read from Marvel this week? Oh, I don't know. I might have reviewed it for that there website that we do on the side. It might possibly, if you was paying attention, have gone up on Saturday. It might have involved a number in the word Avengers and Dominic Fortune.
Mm-hmm. Well, keeping in mind that not everybody who listens to our show actually goes to the website, if you can believe that. I don't believe
MajorSpoilers.com. Yeah. Avengers 1959 number 2 was my favorite read of the week.
Okay. That's not a time travel story. That's just this is what happened back in 1959.
It's sort of one of those imaginary flashbacks.
Okay. Cool. Let's flip over to the DC Universe. Remember that controversial Catwoman? And how at the end of Catwoman number 1, she and Batman were about to get it on, and most of their clothes stayed on.
You're getting it on.
Catwoman number 2 opens with them getting it on, and sure enough, most of their clothes stay on. to an extent. And this is really, it's kind of interesting because a lot of the story is driven by Selina's inner dialogue and how she's like, oh, I really like Batman. I hope he likes me. He's so hunky. And of course, she doesn't know who Batman really is under the mask. But the big point in this story is she's been tasked or is trying. This is a big revenge story. She's trying to get revenge on a member of the Russian mob. And to kind of set things up, she's stolen a painting of a horse that means nothing, has no artistic value, no monetary value, but it means a lot to these Russian mob families. And she steals it, and she's willing to give it back, but she pits two of the crime mobs against each other. And in order for the exchange to go down, she does it at one of Bruce Wayne's big extravaganzas. And of course, she shows up.
Extravagances?
Yes. She shows up not looking like the Selina Kyle we know, but a blonde.
More like Selena
sexy
Gomez.
Lady, except, yeah. And Bruce Wayne instantly recognizes her as Catwoman, but she doesn't connect that it's Bruce Wayne. In fact, she makes several comments about, oh man, he's quite the playboy, and maybe in a different time I'd be interested in him, but man, he smells of scotch, and boy, he's not going to remember me tomorrow. And just kind of cements that Bruce Wayne is quite the actor when it comes to playing the drunk playboy. Selina goes into one of the back rooms where the exchange is supposed to take place. The two Russian mobs see each other. Bruce Wayne shows up. Selina tries to rescue him from the shenanigans that are about to ensue. Plants a big kiss on him, throws a firecracker in the room full of Russian thugs with guns, and they shoot each other, including the big Russian mobster that she's been trying to get her revenge on. Pretty good revenge story, actually, in the way that it plays out. Problem is, when she goes back to her friend Lola's apartment, she finds out her friend Lola is dead, which I'm sure a lot of people are going to have problems with. And then she's immediately attacked by a new character who at first I thought was going to be, oh, they're reintroducing Black Mask into this universe. And then the character steps out and he goes, you can call me Bone. You must be the irritating woman who dresses up like a cat and has been stealing from me. And that's where the issue ends. I really thought
Smiley
we were going to see.
Smiley Bone or Phony Bone?
No, it is Scary Bone. Mobstery Bone. So, yeah.
And I miss my Uncle Joe.
The art in this issue isn't bad. The coloring is really weird, especially how it's like everybody has W.C. Fields' disease, the rosacea, because all their noses are rosy throughout the issue. This is art
everybody
drunk.
Yeah, everybody's drunk. And it's just really odd to see that the coloring on the noses is so different. Otherwise, the art is pretty dynamic. There's a lot of movement in the art. It does get very violent. It does get very sexy. As Jed Winnick said months ago in an interview, this is going to be a different Catwoman, and we are certainly seeing a different Catwoman than what we've seen in past volumes. This is not too bad of a story, but I still think that it's wavering as far as the attention span is going to be for many people. And so I'm only going to give this 3 out of 5 slices of meatloaf. I don't remember what I gave the first one, or if I thought the first one was really that good. But 3 out of 5, if you were irate at the last one, you should probably pick this one up so you can see if your ire is justified. Yes. Yes. Rodrigo, what have you got for us? You got an independent comic.
Yes. From
Dynamite.
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 I'm sure they love that.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure J.J. Walker loves it too.
Yep. It is Vampirella number 11, in which Vampirella learns a thing. So in this story, Vampirella and her assistant, we'll call her Girl Watson.
Okay.
They go to this house and they're like, oh, we need your help with a demon. So they are like trying to exorcise a demon, and it goes into the assistant, and then they go into a dream sequence, and then the assistant beats the demon, and the demon goes into an old lady.
Uh-oh.
That's your plot summary there. As far as the art, I really wasn't all that impressed by it. you know, it seemed like the proportions of people's faces changed a lot.
Mm.
It seemed like there were moments when the detail in just certain pages just dropped drastically, and sometimes it was, you know, pretty detailed.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. The dialogue was kind of problematic for me. I thought there were times when it was clear that a character was trying to, obviously, or the author wanted us to feel that this character was being deep or, like, mysterious or whatever, you know, sort of doing very poetic, like, I am that which, you know, but it kind of comes across as Darkwing Duck type stuff, you know.
So the sidekick's name is Abigail?
What is a sidekick?
I don't remember what the sidekick's name is.
Yeah, it's like Dublin Check.
Yeah, yeah.
Webigail. Yes, Webigail. No, Webigail is from DuckTales. Goslin is
oh,
the
yeah,
sidekick
Goslin,
from
that's right.
Darkwing Duck. And there's a couple times when it's supposed to be kind of intimidating or like poetic dialogue, and it just kind of sounds like somebody's trying too hard, which we might talk about a little bit more later. All in all, not really that impressed by it. Again, I haven't been following the storyline, so I don't know if anything has led us to this, but this felt like it's clear that the relationship between Vampirella and her assistant is developing.
Mm-hmm.
But this story in and of itself feels like a one-shot thing, like an episode of a straight up an episodic TV show, like,
oh yeah, yeah,
your Warehouse 13s or
your Buffy's or
your X-Files before season 3.
Before season 3.
All in all, I'd give this 2 slices of meatloaf. It was just kind of generally unimpressive. If, you know, we do have a comment section, so if you've been following it and you think that I've missed something, you can certainly let me know. And I read the comments.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, you do. He comes every week.
Did you see what people wrote in the...
Oh, my God. People just don't get it.
Ah, PayPal.
Ah.
All right, and listeners, you can go and check out many, 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 many more reviews, including Avengers 1959, over at the MajorSpoilers.com website. Right under the reviews section, where you can find a quick listing of some of the 15 recent ones that we've done over on the right column. In fact, over on the right column, you will see our weekly poll of the week.
It's time!
Yes, it is time.
For the Major Spoilers, poll of the week!
Poll of the week this week. In case people haven't noticed, it's October. And every year for the past 5 years, we have done a costume contest. And this year, we're giving away the granddaddy of all prizes that we've ever given away, an iPad 2 to some lucky winner.
Electric Boogaloo.
Now, we had a crap ton of entrants this year. I think it was like 70-some, Rodrigo. Is that what it came out to be?
Yeah, there were a bucket.
Now, of course, some people entered multiple times, and that's fine. Mm-hmm.
There's
some
costumes.
Very talented people out there modeling a bunch of different costumes. And it was up to the Major Spoilers crew, Matthew, Rodrigo, myself, about 4 or 5 other people,
mm-hmm.
all sat down and we had
the
rank.
Rest.
Yes, Matthew, Steven, and me, and the rest of the Lightman Institute.
Skrull Brian.
All of our other interns.
Otter Disaster. Jimmy.
The Professor
Thurgood,
and Marianne.
Thurgood Marshall.
Right.
Voted. Dante
Webigail and Launchpad,
mm-hmm.
Rob and Rob,
right?
You know,
and also Rob and Rob,
yes, and Rob and Rob. And we narrowed it down what we thought was going to be 5. I thought, you know, this weighted ranking system works out pretty good, although
yeah.
It's weird because somebody could rank somebody as this is my favorite costume,
mm-hmm.
and all it takes is 2 other people to give another entrant 2 mediocre ratings, and it pushes that higher up on the list, which
right.
is fine,
because
right. that's kind of how it works out.
Mm-hmm.
But we thought we'd end up with just 5, and we thought there'd be a clear separation in which 5
right.
were in the top.
Wheat, chaff.
Well, no, there is no chaff. Mm. They're all wonderful, unique people who have entered this contest.
You are all wheat.
You're all beautiful snowflakes.
But we ended up not with five entries, Rodrigo. We ended up with seven people in our finalists.
This system is broken.
No, it's not really broken. I think we could tweak it a little bit, but I think it actually works pretty well.
That looks,
yeah,
come out okay, I think.
But the thing is, now it's out of our hands. We now have the major spoilers poll this week is the listeners, the readers, the fans of the costume cosplayers all get to go vote on who they want to win out of our selection. So this week, this year, I think we've got some pretty good entries. We got a guy dressed as Deadpool. We got a girl dressed as Jinx from the Teen Titans series. The
T-E-E-N-T-I-T-A-N-S Teen Titans. Ah, konnichiwa.
I thought she was baby Rita Repulsa. I did not know who Jinx was, quite frankly.
Super Adaptoid is in the list. There is a pretty funkadelic warlock that made made the list. MODOK, which is pretty
MODOK.
Cool.
MODOK.
A very cute Lady Blackhawk. And Mr. Freeze, which looks just like the animated series Mr. Freeze, almost looks like an action figure.
Yeah,
instead
I don't know
of
what
saying,
he did to his head.
Bald cap, maybe?
Put his whole head in plastic.
Yeah. It's got to be hot in there. You can see it steaming up right where his mouth is in those pictures.
No, that's a freeze effect.
Rodrigo, without saying who is your favorite among the seven, who else did you think were really great, great cosplayers this year?
I thought that some of the boobies were good.
Electro Woman was particularly well done.
Yeah, there were some kind of not. There were plenty of people showing off some skin.
Uh huh.
But not as much skin in any individual costumes has been shown in previous years.
Right.
We've gotten some super naked people before.
But unfortunately, not naked people before.
Yes, well, that might be fortunate.
I agree.
Yeah, nobody went as Dr. Manhattan this year, thank God.
I did, actually. I'm going to work on Monday in my Dr. Manhattan costume.
You've been warned, listeners.
I actually have my special pixelation set up. It's going to be awesome.
Put it away, John. We had a bunch of Scarlet Witches, and a lot of them were really good.
You know, in years
although
past,
I wonder if the Scarlet Witch contingent didn't accidentally kind of take itself out of the running. It's kind of how you have like an independent candidate that is too close to one of the main party's candidates,
and
it ends up like pulling that guy out.
You know, in years past, whenever I displayed all the entrants, I would say, "Well, here's a group of Scarlet Witches. Here's a group of Spider-Man. Here's a group of Jokers."
Mm-hmm.
This year, I just totally randomized it.
Right.
So when you look at it, you know, you see a Scarlet Witch up top. You see a Scarlet Witch down below. You see a couple of Jokers. A couple of Red Skulls were there this year.
The Mary Marvel contingent, both Dark Mary Marvel and Classic Mary Marvel were very cute. Yeah. Classic Mary Marvel was just adorable.
There was a Shikari.
Yeah. 70s Supergirl with her hot pants and little flippy shoes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very simple costume, but it was one of the most accurate superhero costumes I've seen because that was the actual costume that she wore in like 1967 or something.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool. Cardboard Tube Samurai.
Yeah.
He cracked me up.
Shikari.
Was amazing. And nobody knows who Shikari is but me and five
she's
guys
a who Legion of Superheroes person.
I know because she combines the two things that I like best about the Legion.
Shikara and
the bugs and Dawnstar.
Teleporting.
She's a monster and she's a hot girl.
Yeah. There were some really good ones. I really like the Super Adaptoid one.
Yeah.
I like the
Super Adaptoid is phenomenal.
The one girl who went as Evil Supergirl from the Kotobukiya little statues that they have, the anime statues. I thought that one was a pretty good
that was really strong.
Representation. And then somebody went as the Black Terror, which I liked as well.
That was a good one.
Matthew, did you have some favorites on that list?
I went over many of my favorites. I think Firestar was really adorable. The Firestar, there was the Modesty Blaze, extremely entertaining. Maybe not necessarily as high profile as you'd expect, but I think that what I really appreciated this year was the tendency to have characters where you're like, okay, I'm MODOK.
Right.
Who would think to dress up as MODOK and to do a convincing MODOK or the Warlock? MODOK and Warlock both made it into the final seven, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the Super Adaptoid was ridiculously accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact,
that is an incredible chunk of work.
Well, yeah, I guess when people go and look at the finalist page, they'll get to see all the images that were sent. And he goes through the whole thing of let me change and adapt different, you know, here's me with Wolverine claws and with fire powers. And here's me with, you know, whatever else he's got.
Thorhammer.
I hardly wait.
You want to make any predictions?
Me?
Yes.
Sure. I believe that someone in a costume will win.
Do you have a certain costume in mind?
Well, no, that wouldn't be a prediction. That would be a prognostication.
Well, prognosticate.
Of the seven, if I had a vote?
Well, you do, because you can vote.
Aha! Can I tell who I voted?
You can if you want.
Well,
it's not cheating.
I believe that everyone is awesome, but if I were to sit down right this instant and I did not, you know, represent Major Spoilers in any way, and by the way, it should be noted that I do not represent Major Spoilers in most ways, I would probably say the Super Adaptoid just from the sheer amount of work that had to go into that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the individual, if you look at the chainmail seems to be individual flaps.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. And plus, I've always loved the Super Adaptoid. One of the first comic books I ever bought was Iron Man 40 Pravda, which was a Super Adaptoid fighting Iron Man, which is kind of nice. And he beat him by having the Super Adaptoid adapt his heart condition and die.
Mm-hmm.
That's brilliant. That's how you beat the Super Adaptoid.
Yep.
Super Adaptoid comes in and you're like, Professor Hawking, go!
I will stop you, Super Adaptoid.
Rodrigo, what about you?
I think that in previous years... Matthew
cracks himself. Now, normally, I would edit these comments out, but not this week.
It's okay. Matthew has come to the realization that he's actually a bad person.
Okay.
That's actual legitimate, you know, evil cackling.
Professor Hawking saves the day because he's a heroic presence.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it was. In previous years, there's been a... I think what tends to get me... What I like the most is seeing an adaptation where somebody takes like the personality of the costume itself and manages to translate it into the costume, like from whatever word it comes from. I was a big fan of Teen Titans Robin because they made the costume very blocky,
right,
and rectangular like the actual drawings. Of course, the Atomic Robo, I think, also from that
year. Yeah.
Was really well done because it had that, you know, if you looked at it from the side, it looked like it had been drawn that
right,
way.
Right.
So I'm a big fan of Jinx because, you know, she took that entirely improbable hair and managed to pull it off and made everything work really well. And she looks like that character.
Yeah. When it first came in, I was like, oh, are we doing video game characters? What's that? Calamari or whatever that little...
Katamari.
Yeah. That's what I was like. Oh. And I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, sure, that works. I really, really like the Mr. Freeze. I think that one is just simple, just like you were saying. It looks like something right out of the cartoon or right out of the animated series comic book.
He's a Batman villain.
Well, yeah, that too. I really also like the Warlock, and I think the Warlock one works best if you were in under a black light.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine what that thing would look like under a black light. Probably very electric. When I first saw Super Adaptoid, I was like, wow, this is going to be the sure winner for sure. But I really like the cute lady Blackhawk.
Oh, yeah. It's all about execution. It's like,
right.
you know, that's a jacket and a hat, but all put together, it's like, yeah.
And what's funny is she's in, I think she entered like four times in four different costumes. Mm-hmm. And each time you look at her in a different costume, you're like, that's not the same
she
girl.
She looks entirely different.
She does look really different from one to one. But I went with Mr. Freeze because I really liked how that one changed. And there is an entire week of voting that's going to go on. So not only can you, the listeners, go and vote today, voting closes October 31st, right around 11:59 p.m. Central Daylight Time. But all of these people who I guess all belong to the same, I didn't realize it when the finals, when the finalists were announced, they all belong to the same cosplay organization. I think in Florida is where they're at. They can solicit their own members and go and pitch. And there's going to be a lot of votes by the end of next week. Mm-hmm. By this time next week, I'm going to predict 2,000 people. Nice. We're almost there. We're halfway there. Almost halfway to, there today.
Nice. Winner gets an iPad.
Winner gets an iPad 2. Not two iPads, but iPad 2.
And everyone gets
an iPad as well.
And what's real interesting is right now the voting is really close. Usually I say at about 100, you can tell who the clear winner is going to be. Not right now.
No.
Not right now.
Yeah.
There
that
is,
100 thing only works up till about 350, at which point things start really getting weird.
Yeah. Who's in the lead right now, Matthew?
750 votes. The lead right now, very, very slight lead, Deadpool. Mm-hmm. Who, by the way, I have to admit, I love the fact that he has the Deadpool yellow and Helvetica caption boxes behind his head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's actually pretty cool in one of the pictures. But Deadpool is in the lead. Jinx is very close. Super Adaptoid very close behind that. Really, it's pretty much about a five-way dance right now. And I think if we're, you know, if we expect 2,000, this could go anybody's direction at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's the difference between the top and the bottom position right now is 12%. 12% of the number of votes in play is like 45.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's an awful lot.
You know, originally when this voting started out this morning, it started out with MODOK at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jinx was in the lead for quite a while. And then it's Super Adaptoid flipped up. And now Deadpool, about this afternoon, Deadpool took the lead and it just kind of fell in line with that. And of course, there are a lot of comments. A lot of comments, both positive and a few negative comments about some of the costumes, but I think they're all winners. If I could give them all an iPad, I would. But you know what? We don't have those kinds of funds.
No.
Because people aren't donating money. People want to know what their money goes to. Part of it goes to this great prize and getting more people to see Major Spoilers. Holy crap. You know how many people came to the site yesterday and today?
A lot.
A crap ton.
92. I think,
yeah. Take that times a million.
92. 2,000.
All right, everybody. Head over there.
I don't believe
cast your vote before the end of October 31st. The winner shall be crowned and walk away dancing. Neener, neener, neener. I got an iPad.
You know what? If they're all part of the same group, maybe they could share the iPad for grouping.
Yeah.
Like they do on the Starship Enterprise.
Spoken as the father of one child in the house.
There's a reason for that. When something 10 pounds and 24 inches tall comes out of you, you're done. This is what I'm told.
All right, everybody, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about James O'Barr's The Crow.
The Crow.
The Crow.
Hey, Major Spoilers, this is Blue Yonder from the site. I actually read The Crow a couple weeks ago, and thanks to someone on the site, Matthew, talking about a site which reviews tropes on TV, I was able to learn a great deal of background on The Crow, especially about the tragedy which eventually inspired James O'Barr to write The Crow, and that adds, I think, a whole new dimension to The Crow. You quickly realize that everything Eric Draven is experiencing, James O'Barr has experienced, and that makes this comic very poetic, but it also makes it very painful. It's a good book. I like the art. The art's a little bit all over the place. Sometimes it's very inky and indie, and other times it's very graceful and painted. But all in all, it's a very good read. I think Eric Draven's journey starts with denial and kind of ends with acceptance in a very cathartic way. I'm going to quit rambling, but it's a good book. It may not be for everyone. It's a little bit different than the movie, despite having the basic plot. But I definitely recommend it, and I can't wait to see what you guys think of it. Bye.
Ka-ka!
All right. Thank you, thank you, thank you, everybody, for calling in and leaving a comment. Geez, I guess I should have checked to make sure we even had comments. That's what I get for recording this show before I lay down.
Here's a comment!
While drunk.
Yes, while drunk, and before I listen to all of those Skype messages. Let's see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's got to be at least 8 messages. Sir, your cable will be turned off Thursday if you do not turn in your bill. Sir, this is the
We'd
water
like to
department.
Tell you the good news about... Never mind.
Ooh, hey, speaking of good news, do you guys, speaking of Cthulhu and the good news, you guys watch Ben 10?
Sometimes.
There was a creepy episode, it was like 3 weeks ago, where Ben 10's girlfriend, Julie, she's the tennis star, she's only ranked 86th in the nation, but she is approached by this group of people called the Circle of Fire group or something like this. Join our group, it'll change your life. And it really comes off as a
cult.
As a cult. And they worship Dagon.
Really?
Yes. And they name him by name Dagon in the episode. And the art that you see is very Cthulhu-like. Dagon came and gave the people fire and the wheel and helped advance civilization.
Wow.
Ben 10 goes to this and is like, oh, this is all hockey puck. And basically laughs and gets Julie mad at him because, you know, it's illegal for alien technology to be used to advance a culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they go inside the secret chamber and lo and behold, there is something that looks like Dagon Cthulhu. And it is Vilgax in his natural state of not able to form a body. But man, it was pretty cool. I was like, no way. They're pulling from the Cthulhu myth or from the old gods mythos, the Lovecraftian mythos to create this character. And I thought that was pretty cool. So if you hadn't seen it, The Horror from Beyond. Speaking of horrors from beyond, let's talk about The Crow. One night, a guy and his girl were out celebrating. And they spent all their money on an engagement ring in a house, which is probably why they couldn't afford to go take their car down to the shop to get it serviced, because it breaks down. And while they're trying to fix it, a gang of ne'er-do-wells show up, shoot Eric in the head twice, rape his girlfriend, leave her for dead, leave him for dead. And then a tale of revenge takes place.
A year later.
The Crow.
The Crow.
So break it down, Matthew. You're the one that recommended this book this week.
I am, because it's scary, blah, scary stuff. Ooh, Halloween-y-like things. This, if you have seen the movie The Crow, you have roughly 12 to 15% of what actually happens in this book. Kind of sort of there, but in a different order. And as Steven said, there's a bad thing, and then there's a shooting on the road. And there has been a little bit of dissonance among those of us who actually read it this week as to whether Eric dies or not. Either way.
Well, he dies.
1 year later.
There's no doubt that he dies. They say right there that he died on the operating table.
And a year later, a crow resurrects him.
No, it doesn't say a year later a crow resurrects him.
Yeah, see, this is what's going to cause the podcast to break into two separate sects.
Probably.
There's the ones that say that the crow, was up and around a few minutes later, and the ones that say that it took a year for him to resurrect. I'll just
Steven
be an apologist.
Steven is a secular crowite, whereas I myself am actually probably
he's a Hasidic crowite.
We only have the first 3 chapters. I'm sorry, that was funny. Okay, so, anyway, a year later, Eric, either having come back from the dead at some point, or awakened on an operating table at some point, sets in motion an elaborate, well, I wouldn't even say elaborate, an inexorable plot for revenge against the gang schmucks who killed his girlfriend.
Right.
And it's interesting to note that this book was done in stages over the course of, I want to say, like 5 or 6 years.
Ten years from start to finish.
So even from page to page, you can watch Obar's art evolving.
Well, and
I honestly...
Go ahead and say what you're going to say.
I honestly actually read the last book first about a year or so before the movie came out, and I can't tell you whether the movie being in production made me read the comic or whether the comic coming back out because the movie was in production came to my attention. But I read like the last chapter first and then went back and filled in. Now, this is one where I do not own all of the original issues because, quite frankly, they are nearly impossible.
Well, yeah, if you can find the original issues, you've got a mint right there. But these are collected, and there's a couple of different versions. And the one that we are reading is the author edition. The author edition came out much later, and includes all of the dreamy sequences, all of the emo poetry, all of that stuff is included in here. So when we talk about evolution of the art, I just really do not like the art in this book. But I can see that as his art is evolving. And especially when you add in these dream sequence parts where it's all kind of like a watery wash kind of look to it. Yeah, you can see the evolution of the art of what would have come, you know, 10 years later or 15 years later or whenever these bonus sections were added in. But initially, the art just doesn't do much for me. There are some panels which look really brilliant, and then there are some where it's just, I don't know, a mess to me.
Yeah. Well, and it's a very young... I mean, even near the end, it's a very young artist at work. And I think that probably, for me, the biggest complaint about the Crow book, this actual comic book, this collected series, is what it spawned. Not just the Crow movie, not just the Crow TV series, not just the endless Crow Redux limited series that have come out from like 10 different characters, but kind of, you know, big chunks of the... and I'm not casting aspersions, but big chunks of some of the youthful culture about the time that I was getting out of the youth and some of the emo kids cutting themselves and things of that nature. Again, not casting aspersions. It's just, it seems like the iconography of this book has blown up huge and it's gone places that I'm just kind of like, really? I don't know. So that's kind of a thing for me.
Yeah. And this is your typical...
No, this is your prototypical.
Okay, this is your prototypical revenge film, because it's just like, let's go from person to person to person and tell me how you're going, you know, who's next, where they're at. I'm going to kill you. And then at the end, I should have some sense of relief and vindication or the sense of justice of killing all these people in brutal ways. And we do see some pretty brutal murders. I mean, there's one point where he pops out on some gangster guy and slashes his... got a samurai sword and just slashes his legs off to where the guy passes out for a moment and he wakes up and he goes, hey, how come you took off my boots and they're laying over there? Can I put on my boots? I'm getting cold and I'm getting sleepy. And Eric, the Crow, Eric is saying, hey, tell me where the next person is and you can put on your boots. And he's like, okay, I tell you where the guy is. I'm going to go to sleep now. I guess I don't need those boots, because he's bleeding out all over the street.
Right.
The bad guys are presented as vile bad guys. You've got drug dealers. You've got gangbangers. You've got rapists. You've got potentially child molesters, maybe. I don't know. It's not really super clear on that part, but some of them are some of them have a regret for what they've done. You know, I feel bad that I'm this way. Others of the villains are like, you know what? I'm a bad guy. And though I know I'm a bad guy, I don't regret a single thing I've done because society has made me this way. Rodrigo, what are some thoughts on this book?
What I thought was, here's the thing. When I was like, oh, we're going to do the Crow, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of too bad, because the Crow is that prototypical, like, 90s badass, right? It's where all 90s badasses exploded out of. That's a weird way of putting that.
You know, you got the Pepto-Bismol to take care of that.
Well, and clearly there's a serious lack of pink in the 90s. But it's interesting, because one of the, you know, when you first see him, the guy is like, oh yeah, who are you? I'm gonna shank you, and shanks him, right? And he's like, that does not hurt me, because I am awesome and I am the Crow. now tell me where those guys are. And eventually he talks the guy into telling him where the guys, where the other guys are. I'm like, oh, well, maybe this book isn't at all what I thought it was going to be.
Did you think it was going to be supernatural stuff?
No, well, that's, it's not that. Is I thought it was just going to be somebody opens a door, screen goes red.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he remembers himself being shot down in his wedding dress.
Right.
And go from there.
Yeah.
So when I saw this first sequence, I was like, oh, maybe there's more to this. But pretty soon there wasn't.
Right.
Really, my main complaint about this, and really it's the only real complaint that I have about it. And we'll get to what I like about it maybe a little bit more. My main complaint about this book is that there's no conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of action. There's plenty of fighting.
There's internal strife and conflict. I miss my whatever her name is.
That's not conflict, though, because there's nothing that's stopping him from missing her.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, he can't be with her.
Right.
But that's the thing. He can't be with her. So it's not like she's kidnapped and the bad guys are keeping her from
him. Right.
That's done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a done deal from the beginning that he's just going to kill them all. He's never in danger. You never say, oh, no, the crow might not finish, or, you know, Eric might not finish his roaring rampage of revenge.
Yeah.
You know, from the beginning, it's very clear what's going to happen throughout. And partially, that's kind of annoying, because I read three more volumes that I felt I needed to, you know, because I know what he's going to do. You just have to watch him do it. Now, what I did like about it is that this is a very, like, for just simple thing, it's a very ambitious book.
Mm-hmm.
And the author seems to just really throw himself into it.
Yeah, so a little bit of history.
There's a lot going on here, and it all, even, you know, I'm not going to say that it's like this guy lost somebody or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, he did. This is actually the story. So when James O'Barr was 18 years old, he lost his fiance to a drunk driver.
Mm.
18 years old, lost the love of his life, totally devastated by this. And so I don't know if he was already in the military, but at the time where he decided to work on this comic or start this comic in 1981, he was in Berlin in the military, and he thought that this comic, this story that we're seeing, this revenge story, would help ease that pain. But instead, O'Barr goes on record as saying this is almost like rubbing salt into the wound. It just compounded the situation. And it wasn't until 1989 when he had that first volume completed. So 8 years that he spent working on that first volume, whatever it was, Torture and Pain or whatever the first volume is. Right. And then that was released by Caliber. And then, of course, it goes on. It's a couple of 3 years later, they canceled it. 3 years later, he had the next volume started. And then I think it was like 10 years by the time that the entire volume that we're reading is done.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it does come from somebody who...
Yeah.
Went through some kind of pain.
And it's clear that there's something very personal here. Even, you know, I mean, I didn't know any of this. But it's clear from the poetry, from the way that the characters express themselves,
mm-hmm.
that there is, like, this is a serious attempt at a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the author is trying to engage you in this bloody mess, but it's actually, you know, there are points that he's trying to make,
mm-hmm.
and those I feel came across pretty well, and
I think
were
that
enjoyable.
It's easy to kind of look at this and to dismiss the parts of it that feel like adolescent poetry, that feel like that, you know, the teenage angst, that feels like it's really informed by a viewpoint that's even younger than the youngest of us by like a decade.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's exactly what I love about this, is that it is such a, not necessarily pure, but it's such an unfiltered viewpoint. And it reminds me of being that, oh, 19 is so difficult and one truly is the one, the loneliest number. You know, it channels into that. It's the same thing where, you know, sometimes I'll sit up and, you know, I like to listen to certain music because it makes me feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
There's a particular song on my I don't call it an iPod, the MP3 player of my Android phone, that if I'm at work, I can't listen to. If I'm sitting at, you know, and I'm bagging comics and Toto's 99 comes up, cannot listen to it there. I have to listen to it either in the car or at some point where I can just sit there and go, oh, I'm so sad right now.
Oh, that's rough.
And this,
because I brought that up on the show before, like that song specifically.
Go back and listen.
I was like, I'm like, Matthew's acting weird now.
Which song is that?
Listen to the point where Rodrigo brings up, and it's about 10 episodes ago. Rodrigo brings up Toto's 99. For the rest of that show, I am remarkably low key because that song's in my head and I'm like, but that's fun. And it's, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of liberating in a way to take your inner 18-year-old and let him angst and let him just kind of go, I miss you, Shelley, and, you know, living alone in the empty house and shooting down the people that murdered your love. Everything that I love has died and I have lost everything. So now I'm going to murder people in particularly horrible ways. So even the parts of the story that don't work for me, the parts where there's a little too much, you know, Ian Curtis of Joy Division in the art, or a little too much, you know, quoting of Rimbo or whomever that person is, I still enjoy it because it's such a specific, such a personal, I guess, perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And throughout it, you can actually see, you know, because it took so long for this book to be written and drawn, you see that adolescent kind of growing in as an artist. And that never really going away, but having it kind of, you know, change, kind of age like, you know, bad cheese or maybe good cheese. So that's part of the thing that I really enjoy about this book is that point where you can just be a depressed 17-year-old again.
Mm-hmm. I think the more interesting aspect for me, you know, all of this taken into account, I was just like, so in the movie, he's supposed to be like a supernatural spirit of vengeance kind of guy. Mm-hmm. But in this book, is he a supernatural spirit or is he simply a man that is been through major surgery after having half his head blown off, got metal plates in his head and probably metal plates in his body, which is why some of these things don't bother him. We see him shooting up morphine to help kill the pain. One can imagine that he might have a metal plate in his head if half your brain is missing. And if you think about the strange case of Phineas Gage, it might explain a lot of his detachment and his inability to feel some pain.
Hmm.
So that's kind of how I went about it. Not as some spirit, supernatural spirit, because the spirit guide, the Crow, is the one that is the is it real or isn't it real aspect of the story.
You know, I saw the movie first, so I did not, you know, once you brought it up, I was like, oh, yeah, you could read it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Going back through, there's nothing that explicitly says, and then I came back from the dead. But I saw especially some of the, your chiaroscuro, softer moments as either allegorical or possibly like straight up, representations of that journey. And there's this thing where he's on a train and he sees a horse get mm-hmm. wrapped up in some barbed wire
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And I was like, I interpreted that as like him remembering actually literally coming mm-hmm. back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what mm-hmm. I figure that was. But again, there's nothing, it's never explicit. So that could very well be the fever dream of somebody who was shot in the head.
True.
Right.
True, true, true.
And for me, when we get to that climax where he, you know, he climbs onto Shelley's grave, and my mind looked at it. There's two headstones set right next to each other. My brain says, okay, one is Shelley's grave, one is his, but it doesn't explicitly say that. There's nothing in the text that, you know, there's nothing that says, you know, Eric's dead. There's nothing in this book that gives Eric a last name. The last name Eric Draven is actually something that was put together for the movie. So he is just Eric throughout this entire text.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, the fact that there is no headstone is part of the fact that Eric is just Eric. Eric is author avatar in this case, essentially
mm-hmm.
taking out, you know, whatever the writer's rage is against personifying something that cannot be personified and taking out, you know, the rage that he felt and the loss that he felt
mm-hmm.
on imaginary straw people, kind of, you know, like a fight on the internet.
And I'm certainly not trying to take away from what the intent was behind this in a way to get rid of the get rid of the pain that the author was suffering from. But I don't think that the, well, the people who have seen the seen the movie, I don't think know the backstory, like Rodrigo didn't know the backstory about this. So that gives rise to all of the people who want to think of the Crow as that angst only, hello, my name is Simon and I'm sad kind of lifestyle. But I don't know. This book really, except for the revenge aspect of it, this book really didn't do anything for me.
The one thing that I really appreciate, and I had forgotten when I did this rereading, is we see the brutal murder of Top Dollar. We see Tintin get pinned down. We see Fun Boy killed on panel with an overdose. We see all these people brutally murdered. And the ringleader of it all, T-Bird, we get to the end, and Eric basically chases T-Bird in his resurrected car to the point where they're in the road where T-Bird killed him and killed Shelley, and it fades to black. We don't see what happens to T-Bird. And that is one of the most horrifying parts of this story, because I start thinking, you know, we saw Skank get his head cut off, and we saw Tintin get, you know, to use the line from the movie, he got knives stuck in all of his organs in alphabetical order. My God, think about what happened to T-Bird at the end here.
Well, it's the only thing that we're left to know is that final panel where Eric's holding a hammer and then it goes to black. And I'm trying to think of the Coen. Is it Blood Simple, the Coen Brothers movie, where there's that scene where the guy's just dragging this shovel on the asphalt of the highway, and you got this low shot that kind of tracks with that shovel just dragging on the highway, and you hear it going, and there's the guy at the side of the road just basically like, no, no. And then you don't know what happens next. You see the shovel handle go up, but you don't know what happens next, presumably. The person is dead.
I've never seen that movie. So.
I think that's the one it is. But that's kind of, you know, you leave it up to the imagination of how brutal the final sequence of his demise is going to be. Or did you think he's not even dead?
Me?
Yeah.
T-Bird?
Oh. Yeah, do you think he gave
T-Bird.
Him...
T-Bird's dead as hell. In my head, yeah, the death of T-Bird is really kind of the point of all this. It's it's the grand guignol, if you will. It's the, you know, the thing that he has been doing. He's been building up to the point where he gets his revenge on T-Bird, and then he goes and he's dead again, or in your case, dead for the first time.
Yeah.
But he was dead.
Well, yeah, they say he died on the operating table, and then he wakes up, and there's a cop standing there going, hey, you know, sorry what happened to your kid, sorry what happened to your girlfriend. If you think of anything, give me a call. Here's my card, see?
Me and my nephew Berserko, see? Captain Hook is actually one of the things that I found to be really tonally difficult, because it's, you know, it's this poetic story of life and death and pale skin and taking revenge. And then they've got this comedy bit, this recurring little, you know, Abbott and Costello shtick with Captain Hook. I'm like, what? I don't remember any of this in the Brandon Lee movie. This is all silly stuff here. But by no means is it a perfect work. But it's definitely a fascinating work, and it's one that I can sit here and just go back and forth over it. And I think it's one that because of the problems that we had, well, not problems, I guess the different interpretations that we ran into.
Right.
I think that's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it so revisitable. And that's what makes, if you go to the C's in the Overstreet comic book price guide, there are literally 24 Crow spinoffs and miniseries and crossovers and Crow Razor and Crow Witchblade and Crow Witchblade Weasel Guy, you know, Earth Girl. So, I mean, there's a lot here, and it's not just prototypical. It's actually almost archetypical. in that there's so many different ways that you could look at this and so much that you can read into it and to some degree have to, because I think of the relative youth and inexperience of the storyteller, that I think that's why it's become such a phenomenon, is you put into it as much as you get out of it. So for me, you know, 1989, I'm buying this book and going, oh, wow, this is very meaningful. I'm 19. It's a little different than if the first time you pick it up, you're 41 years old. So I can definitely see how my interpretation is probably colored by my history with both this comic book and with the character as a property.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, if people want to see an evolution of an art style, I think this book is a good example of an evolution of an art style.
Oh, yeah.
Not necessarily a good example of storytelling, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, your mileage is always going to vary. Bottom line for me is, borrow it from a friend, check it out from the library, but I don't think that this is in a collected form anything to get. Now, I know that the movie was very popular, and there are a number of spinoff books. IDW now is doing a new ongoing, or is it a miniseries? I don't know what that is. That's coming out soon. But this is something that probably is not for everybody.
You know, as far of a, as a work, I'd really hope for the complete thing, you know, good story, good art, all that stuff. You know, the, this book is now important because of what it represents and what it kickstarted, more so than any of its individual merits. So again, you know, if you want to see where Wolverine comes from, pick up The Crow. If you aren't all that interested, then there's probably not going to be all that much in here for you.
Yeah.
Matthew, final thoughts.
Well, first off, I want to start with my entertaining piece of Crow trivia. There was a Crow television series in the mid-1990s, and the actor who played Eric Draven in the Crow television series is currently playing Chairman Kaga's nephew on Iron Chef America. So that's fun, because you know, now I'm old and I watch the Food Network. But secondly, and I think more importantly, this is a book that is, for me, it's fun to read because it's as much about James O'Barr and James O'Barr, you know, dealing with a pretty huge tragedy and putting it in perspective and putting it in a referential perspective, in that it's taking things that he loves, like, you know, the British new wave bands and guys in pancake makeup and ultra violence. You know, there's a very strong kind of, 70s kung fu flick ultra violence here that I kind of like. I honestly love this book. And part of that is because of when I read it. And part of that is because I love the movie. But I know that not everybody's going to really love it. I would say it's definitely a check it out. Don't necessarily pay for it unless you already know it and love it. But if you're willing to go and sit down and just kind of be depressed and listen to Toto's 99 on a gray October afternoon and just kind of think about the girls you loved who are now dead, or also, in my case, all 40 and have children. How is it that all the women I went to high school with are now 40-ish MILFs? How does that work? I don't know. I'm still 17. But I say definitely it's worth a look, if only to see his art evolving over the decade or so that this book was put together.
Yeah. Matthew, have you read the other Crow series that have come out, or have you only
another
just,
the Crow?
Yes, another the Crow.
Another the Crow. No, I haven't. I believe that I read a crossover, the Crow and Razor, who was a bad girl, and I read that because we had a big batch of Razor come into the store, and I write the eBay solicitations. And I couldn't write an eBay solicitation that went, back in 1994, if it had Bugzungas, it would sell. So I actually read The Crow Razor to get a feel for the Razor character so I could put something meaningful in the thing. But no, I haven't read any of the sequels, any of the other stuff. I didn't really watch the television series except in passing. I don't think I've seen the second and third movie. I think I saw the fourth, the one with Kirsten Dunst. But I think I saw that more out of Kirsten Dunst envy. So, no, I haven't.
Oh, okay. I just didn't know if it was more of the same. It looks like the other books that come out are focusing on different characters. So it's not the same Eric character.
Yeah, I think it's kind of it. The thing that I always liken it to is it's kind of like Grendel. Matt Wagner's Grendel is kind of the iconography goes with it. You have different characters in the mask and different characters who – die and are metaphorically and sometimes, you know, completely straightforwardly resurrected to become a crow. But my problem is if it's a crow, it's not necessarily the crow. And because this is so personal, I'm not sure I want to be a part of a whole crow franchise or,
right.
you know, watch a crow television show or go to a crow amusement park. Ride the heroin addiction.
Yeah.
All Space right, Mountain right. in Crow Park is scary. You don't.
That wraps it up for this week's edition of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for being a part of the complete Major Spoilers experience. Next week, I think this is a Rodrigo suggestion, actually, isn't it, Rodrigo?
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we're going to be taking a look at Valve Presents, The Sacrifice and Other Steam-Powered Stories. Why? Because we know that you love comics, and we do too, and we will talk with you soon.
If you have any questions, comments, topic ideas for future shows, or would like to sponsor a show, send an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com. Visit Major Spoilers at majorspoilers.com and be sure to check out the Major Spoilers forum. You can also follow Major Spoilers on Twitter at twitter.com/majorspoilers and on MySpace at myspace.com/majorspoilers.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. About a way, if I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven rich like a man of iron, I might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun bee in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
Major Spoilers is copyright 2011.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.